Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is John Thompson, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of Cambridge. When John Thompson's Merchants of Culture appeared in the summer of 2010, it was the first serious examination of the publishing industry to appear in many decades. Thompson compared himself to an anthropologist studying his subjects in order to explain a field of human activity that strikes many outsiders as baffling and often irrational. The industry recognised itself in the portrait that Thompson drew. One reviewer said succinctly, "If you want to understand the publishing industry, read this book." And another called it a must-read for anyone hoping to become a published writer, or who already is one. Now, some 18 months later, comes a substantially revised paperback edition, which assesses the profound changes now affecting the industry. Print sales are shrinking, and uncertainty is growing over who will call the shots in an electronic landscape in which the roles of publishers, authors, and agents are all being radically re-evaluated. When I met John Thompson in Cambridge recently, I began by remarking that he must have been pleased to see how warmly his analysis was received by the industry itself.
Yeah, for me that's very gratifying. It's interesting for a number of reasons. One is that for years no one paid the slightest bit of attention to the book publishing industry. It's been ignored for three or four decades. The last good study of the book publishing industry was done in the 1970s and published in the United States under the title of Books, the Culture and Commerce of Publishing. But that was the last serious study that was ever done. And for 30 years, the industry has been pretty much ignored in terms of systematic social science research. So when I began this research, there weren't many people who were trying to do what I was doing to understand the structures and dynamics of the industry as a whole. And to many outside observers, the publishing industry, in any case, looked like very old technology, old media. They weren't much interested in it. When I published Merchants of Culture, however, the industry was in the throes of change, and there was a great deal of concern about books and their future, and the book Merchants of Culture, it found a very attentive audience, both in the media and among those people who are practitioners in the industry. For me, that's very gratifying that the response from practitioners in the industry was so positive, because it is, to some extent, a test of whether I've got it right, that people whose industry it is recognize their world in the account that I have given. So for me, that's very gratifying and very important intellectually, that they responded as positively as they did. That doesn't mean they agreed with everything I said in terms of the critical comments that I made on the industry, but the fact that my picture of the industry was a picture that they recognized as accurate of their as an accurate portrayal of their world is for me a very important consideration.
And having painted that picture and having got it so accurate, had you written the book 10 years ago, you could have moved on, you'd be on to your next project. But publishing, being in the situation it is, you have gone back within 2 years and done a substantial new edition, which is what we are here to talk about.
Yes, I always, of course, wanted to release the paperback edition about 18 months after the hardback had come out. And the normal practice would simply be to release the paperback without alterations. However, the industry is going through such rapid change now that I knew it would be dated if I did that. And so I felt it was necessary for me to go back to some of my sources and interview them again and get a sense of how the industry had changed in the 18 to 24 months since I had last interviewed them. So I did that. I re-interviewed about 20 of my key sources in the summer of 2011. And revised the text for the paperback edition, which has just been released in March of 2012.
How did you find their mood from the time you interviewed them before to the more recent session with them?
I think the biggest change is that when I'd interviewed them in earlier years, maybe in 2008, 2009, there was an attitude of apprehension, of concern, of deep uncertainty about what was going to happen, about whether the e-book revolution would happen at all. Very strongly opposed views at that time in 2008, 2009. On the one hand, the digital enthusiasts who were convinced believers that the digital revolution and the e-book revolution would happen very rapidly and very dramatically and essentially turn the industry upside down. On the other hand, the digital skeptics who doubted it would ever happen, who believed that e-books were largely a waste of time in the world of trade publishing. And in the middle, a large number of digital agnostics, as I called them, who were just very uncertain about what would happen and decided not to express very strong views one way or the other. But by the summer of 2011, it was clear that the industry was going in a certain direction and that the e-book revolution would indeed become a reality, had become a reality. So the deeply skeptical views that had been expressed in 2007, 2008 were now no longer pertinent, and those people who had expressed those views were obliged to eat their words. They knew that the industry had begun to change in quite dramatic ways and that it was a new constellation. Now, no one really, of course, knew what was going to happen in the future, but they could not deny that e-books were a reality in the world of trade publishing. So that was the biggest change. Of course, there were a whole range of more subtle and nuanced changes. For example, publishers now, of course, found themselves operating in a context of deep uncertainty about the future. Although it was clear that there was a shift to e-books, it wasn't clear how far that was going to go and what the implications were going to be in so many different ways. And so today, publishers find themselves planning in a context of deep uncertainty about the future. They simply don't know what this world is going to look like in a year's time or 2 years' time. And it makes it very difficult to plan a business when you are so unsure about what the channels to market will be in 2 or 3 years' time and who the main retailers will be and what role they will be playing. It's very, very difficult.
So, John, what was it that changed? Because as you suggest, the e-book future had been long foretold and had been slow in coming. And a point your book makes repeatedly is that technology exists within context. It's not a thing in itself. It's related to all the structure. So was it the Kindle? Was the Kindle the critical tipping point that made an e-book's future a reality?
Yes, it was, I think. I think the introduction of the Kindle in November 2007 was a watershed. There had been countless reading devices produced in the period before that. Many of them had simply proved to be unsuccessful, had never been seriously adopted, and had become museum pieces, with the partial exception of the Sony e-book reader, which also used e-ink and e-paper and had a certain following. But it was still pretty small. However, the real shift came with the introduction of the Kindle in November 2007 in the United States. Following that, you see a very significant surge in ebook sales through 2008-2009. Just to give you a sense of this, if you look at the percentage of sales accounted for by ebooks in large American trade publishing houses, you would find that in 2006 and before, ebooks would have accounted for about 0.1% of their retail sales. Hardly an accounting error, just an insignificant sum of money and an insignificant proportion of their sales. However, by 2010 in the United States, ebooks were accounting for around 8% of trade publishers' sales. And for 2011, the expectation is that ebooks will account for about 20% of total retail sales of the main trade publishing houses in the US. That is a dramatic change. It's huge. And it also obscures the very large variations in the types of books that are selling as ebooks. So if you were to look at commercial fiction, you would find the percentages are even higher. They could be as high as 40% of the total retail sales. So this is a dramatic change in a very short period of time. The Kindle was crucial in this. Of course, the Kindle is not the only successful ebook reader today. There are serious competitors, especially the Barnes & Noble Nook and the iPad are very important alternative ebook reading devices in the US, and there are others. But the Kindle is undoubtedly the most important of these reading devices. It has the largest market share by a significant degree. So why was it so successful? I think part of the explanation is technological. It is a very usable and friendly device. It is sleek and well designed, and it uses e-ink and e-paper very effectively, and many people find that a very agreeable surface to read from. So part of it is technological. But I think there are other factors that are equally, if not more important. One is that, of course, Amazon is an enormously powerful retail organization, and they used their retail market strength to promote this book very aggressively, to promote the reading device very aggressively. And it was right there on their books page. It's in your face. It's very aggressively marketed. The second, the price came down very dramatically and very quickly to a much more affordable level. Third, they, as a very large book-selling operation, they were very proactive about making a lot of content available in a very user-friendly way so that readers were not so intimidated by the device and the complexities of using it. And I think, furthermore, crucial in explaining this is the fact that for many readers, Amazon was already their preferred supplier of books. They had a relationship of trust with a large body of readers, and readers felt confident that if Amazon was marketing the device and providing content for it, that it would be a reliable purchase and a safe and reliable purchase, and it would not become outdated overnight, that it would be a worthwhile investment. And I think finally, Amazon were very aggressive about pricing ebooks. And so they adopted a very aggressive pricing strategy, releasing the New York Times bestsellers and other new releases at $9.99, very cheap, when those books were selling in cloth at $25. So this was a combination of factors that helped to put a great deal of momentum behind the Kindle very early on, and it grabbed market share very aggressively and very quickly, and it really helped to precipitate a big swing towards ebooks within the industry.
Now, can you explain, John, to someone who may be listening to this from outside the publishing industry, why the ebook has occasioned such a profound existential crisis for publishing? Because we're not just talking about the migration from one delivery mechanism to another. We're talking about something which really throws into question many of the long-standing beliefs about the way the publishing business works. So to someone outside the industry, how would you sort of explain the depth of that crisis?
It fundamentally changes the supply chain of the publishing industry, and therefore calls into question the roles, the established roles, of all the traditional players in the industry. They can no longer count on the fact that authors will come through them in order to get their books made available to the public in the future. And so the whole supply chain is now thrown open in ways that are very, very radical. So this is not just a shift from, for example, one book format to another. It's not the same as when Adam Lane pushed for the cheap paperback edition of books. That was a huge revolution in publishing in the 1930s and 40s, the launch of paperback lines and the reinvention of the book format that Alan Lane and others brought about had huge impact on the industry. But this is of an altogether different order, because the launch of a paperback line, of course, meant that new players would enter the industry, paperback publishers and so on and so forth. It would shake up the industry. Indeed, it did shake up the industry. But if there is a migration from print to e-books, from the print-on-paper physical product to an e-book delivered as an electronic file, then the roles of traditional players in the industry can no longer be taken for granted. So who needs a publisher when you can simply upload your file onto Amazon or any other website and make it available? The role of the publisher can no longer be taken for granted. Who needs a bookstore when books can be downloaded from a website? So the role of the traditional retail sector, the bookstores, the chains, etc., etc., they can no longer be taken for granted. Who needs an agent when you can simply write your book and make it available directly to some e-tailer or put it on a website and make it available to others? So all of the traditional players in the industry are now anxious about their role, anxious about their future, no longer confident that they have a future in this industry. And that means that a 500-year history of book publication, book production, and book selling is now up for grabs in a way that has never been the case before. This is truly a major, major upheaval, a real revolution in the industry, at least a revolution, a potential revolution in the industry. I say potential because the other great uncertainty about this is that we don't know if any of that will happen. We don't know if there will be a migration to online content delivery away from physical books. So although the possibility is there and it's a source of great anxiety for all the players in the industry, none of them have any degree of confidence that the shift will occur in the way that I've just sketched it. And so it's a time of deep uncertainty, of not knowing what the future holds in store, but fearing that the future could be dismal for the players that have traditionally played a role in this industry, although it may not be like that at all. So it's that radical nature of the challenge that digitization represents to an industry like book publishing that is the source of great anxiety. And of course, it's not just book publishing. It's all the creative industries. Because what's unique about the creative industries is that what they deal in is a kind of content that can be digitized. It doesn't have to exist in the particular material form that it has existed up till now. So the newspaper doesn't have to exist as a print-on-paper newspaper, nor does the book. And the music doesn't have to exist in the form of a vinyl LP. So all the creative industries find themselves in turmoil in the midst of a technological revolution of this kind, in a way that's completely different, for example, from the refrigerator industry. The refrigerator industry or the car industry are all profoundly affected by the digital revolution because the supply chain becomes digitized, the methods of design and production become digitized and so on. But at the end of the day, a refrigerator is a refrigerator. You can't replace that with digital content. But in the case of the creative industries like music, books, newspapers, magazines, etc., the object itself can vanish, can disappear, and the content can be delivered in another way. You don't need the equivalent of the refrigerator.
The content can be delivered to the consumer, but the consumer can also become a creator. And I was on the Apple website this morning looking at the iBooks author software, and they say there, building a book, and I thought that the choice of the word building was interesting, building a book is as easy as dragging and dropping. Now, this, I think, raises quite profound questions, doesn't it, about what a publisher does and about what a book is. And I suppose it's part of this wider cultural discussion about the value of the book and whether that value is being eroded. And I don't just mean the monetized value, but the cultural value of the book.
Yes, of course, it raises all those questions. It also raises the question of what is an author? In the traditional model, the author produced a text which was then worked over by a series of intermediaries in a supply chain, including agents, publishers, editors, and so on and so forth, and eventually eventually produced as a physical book. But today, it's possible to be an author without any of that, and simply to copy and paste, as you said, or to upload content onto a website or into a piece of software of one kind or another. And so all of these questions are now being posed anew in fresh ways. And it is that turmoil which is causing this angst-ridden reflection on the part of all the players in the traditional book supply chain. As I say, we don't know where this process is going to lead. There is, and we must be careful in thinking it through. There is a great deal of very vague speculation about it. It's very easy to imagine that publishers will disappear, that bookstores will disappear, that agents will disappear, that all of them will disappear. You can certainly conjure up a scenario like that very easily. But it may not happen like that at all, because you have to then think, what roles and functions do different players have in the new emerging supply chains that are occurring and will come into being around e-content, around books and other content delivered electronically? You also have to consider the very real possibility that the physical book will not disappear at all, because there are many readers who actually like physical books. They like the materiality of the book. It's sometimes said that if the physical print on paper book had never been invented, it would be invented today, because it's a very convenient way to carry content, to read it, and to store it. And it's also a beautiful object, and many people treat it as an object which they value in and for itself. They like to have books on bookshelves. They like to have, especially their favorite books, in a form that they can return to time and again and reread or share with friends and others. And the physical book is a great way to do it. You can't do that so easily with electronic content. So it's quite possible that the development of ebooks will go hand in hand rather than replace a continued provision of book content as physical print on paper books. We may find ourselves in a mixed economy of the book, where ebooks and physical books exist quite happily alongside one another, and the proportions that are sold as ebook versus physical book will vary from one genre of book and publishing to another. In some genres, such as genre fiction, romance, sci-fi, mystery, thriller, you may well find that the vast majority of books that are bought and read are in electronic formats, because these may be books that readers don't particularly want to hold on to, don't really want to have on their shelves, don't really want to keep for another day. They are happy simply to read it, to get the content as quick as they can, to read it, and then move on to the next book. Whereas in other types of publishing, such as some areas of nonfiction, as well as professional and academic publishing, physical books might have a much greater life, because there they may be valued by readers, and readers may want to hold on to them and keep them on their shelves. So too with some forms of literary fiction, or with one's favorite author. you want to have the books by your favorite authors as physical books rather than as ebooks. These are all possible scenarios. No one at this point in time really has any idea how this ongoing revolution will reshape the landscape of the book publishing industry in the coming years.
One thing, John, that you say has not changed is the hunt for the big book by the big publisher. So the high investment, high risk, but high reward if it comes off. Now, if I were an aspiring or a struggling writer sitting in the American Midwest or the north of England, far from the centres of publishing in New York and London, and unable to find an agent and unable to find a publisher, I might think this disintermediation of publishing, this direct access to Amazon and iBooks, was a great thing. It was democratizing culture and allowing me to reach readers direct. So should we guard against seeing things too much through the eyes of the big publishers, whose long-term existence is by no means a necessary or a foregone conclusion?
Yes. I mean, as I say, it is a time of great flux. And so there are many new organizations that will emerge to try to bypass traditional channels and traditional supply chains. But let's not go too quickly. Let's remember that traditional publishers do play a number of roles that will continue to be important even in the new environment of ebooks and a mixed economy of books. For example, of course, you can write your book and you can upload it onto a relevant website or make it available in other ways. But there are a number of functions traditionally provided by publishers, both big and small, which you are thereby depriving yourself of. Let me mention three. One, in the traditional book supply chain, there is only one creditor of last resort, and that is the publisher. That is, who puts the money up to pay advances in the case of authors, or to pay for other costs in the production process. And many authors will want advances. They don't want to write for nothing. And what they will find if they are uploading their content onto a website is that any revenue they may get for their work will depend on how many copies are eventually sold. Whereas the great advantage from an author's point of view of the advance is that you get the money whether you sell the books or not. So the publisher takes the risk. They make the advance available. They provide the author with a sum of money, regardless of whether they actually end up selling the books or pulping them. And if they end up pulping them, it's the publisher who takes the loss, not the author. So that's one function the publishers have provided. And if you don't use a publisher, you deprive yourself of that advance. A second, of course, is editorial input, editorial guidance. Good publishers are also good editors. They read texts, they advise authors, they give comments and feedback. And one thing that I was certainly very struck by in doing the research I did on the publishing industry is that many of the large publishing houses remain excellent editorial services of this kind. That is, they really do, some of the editors in these houses really do put a lot of time and effort into reading manuscripts, providing pages of content, comments on them, and helping authors to improve the quality of their work. So if you simply upload your content onto a website, you're not getting any of that editorial input. And third, anyone today can make content available. It's an altogether different thing to get other people to notice that content, to pay attention to it, to buy it, and to read it. So one of the things that the digital revolution is bringing very clearly into focus is that there is a very big difference between publishing in the sense of making content available on the one hand, and on the other, publishing in the sense of getting readers and potential readers to notice your content, to pay attention to it, to buy it, and to read it. Getting them to pay attention to your content, to see it, to know about it, to buy it and read it, is the traditional function of marketing and publicity. And of course, marketing and publicity are changing today too, thanks to the digital revolution, but good publishers are moving with that change and are becoming good and better at marketing content in the new media that are becoming available to them. So the marketing function of publishing remains as important as ever. Indeed, you might say it's more important than ever, because today there is no shortage of content available. The internet is flooded with content, much of it not worth reading, but it's out there. There's tons of it. And so the real challenge today is not to make it available, but it's to get people to notice it. So publishers, if they are thinking through this transformation sensibly and carefully, will see that in many ways they're more valuable than they ever were, because they are uniquely well positioned to get readers to pay attention to new content. And this marketing role of publishing remains, as I say, as important as ever today.
Given that publishers don't control the technology, the delivery devices, and they don't, in the most cases, have direct access to the consumers because there's an intermediary like Amazon or iTunes, do you think they're nonetheless, in that context, doing enough to try to get the kind of deal or the kind of situation, the kind of outcome that they would like from the changes that publishing is undergoing? Or could they be doing more? Because at some points in your book, I get the sense that some of your interviewees are almost sort of paralyzed, or they're waiting and seeing. And of course, none of us knows where we're going to end up. But do you think they're being too passive?
No, I don't think so. I think that's something of an illusion that someone might have looking at the industry from the outside. But in fact, I would say publishers have been enormously proactive about the digital revolution. Back in the 1990s, they were looking over their shoulders and seeing what had happened and was happening in the music industry. And they knew that the same thing could happen in the book publishing industry. They were well aware of it. And so from the late 90s on, they have been, I would say, enormously proactive about trying to ride the wave of the digital revolution. In the late 90s and early 2000s, many publishers invested very heavily in digitizing their backlists and digitizing their content. They invested very heavily in developing ebook programs of one kind or another, even before the market was ready for it. They lost a lot of money in that process. Some of them had to close those divisions down by 2005 because the sales simply weren't there. But the publishers were not reluctant. They were very willing to participate in this change, indeed to try to drive the change. Moreover, if you see what publishers are doing with regard to piracy, you'll see that they are acting, you know, in a very concerted way to try to prevent, or at least to control, piracy in the dispute over the Google Library project illustrates that very well. That is, they decided to take Google to court, and they eventually reached a settlement with Google, although that has not been upheld. So the issues are still very, very open, and it's not at all clear where that's going to end up. And a third example would be the determined resistance of many large publishing houses to the pricing policies of Amazon. Amazon, as many know, decided to price ebooks very cheaply, and they were using a traditional publishing discount model in order to do that. In other words, publishers were selling content to Amazon and giving them a discount off their recommended retail price. And then Amazon chose the price that they wanted to sell that content at. often taking a loss when they sold it as cheaply as $9.99. Many publishers felt that this was not good for the industry in the long run. It was similar to Apple selling songs at 99 cents, and they felt it would be damaging for the industry in the long term. And so they were proactive in resisting that and in moving over to an agency model, which basically means that the retailer, in this case Amazon, takes a percentage off the retail price for selling the content. So the publisher sets the price and then pays the retailer, say 30%, for selling the content. But it is the publisher who sets the price, not the retailer who sets the price. And that is a crucial difference. So in those three examples, you see that the publishing industry has been proactive in trying to shape the direction of the digital revolution and to resist some of the strategies and initiatives of the large technology companies and the large retailers.
John Thompson. Merchants of Culture is available now in a substantially revised and updated paperback edition. You can find full details about it on the Polity website at politybooks.com. I hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.